From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross.
My sweet mother gets up so early in the morning. She turns
today, singer and songwriter Margot Price, whose music is steeped in quintessentially American imagery. She writes about family and growing up in a small town in the Midwest, getting through tough times, and the family's farm, which eventually was bought by a large corporation. Also, we remember playwright and pioneering AIDS activist Larry Kramer, who died Wednesday at the age of 84. His efforts helped push forward the development of treatments to fight the HIV virus. Kramer co-founded two of the most important AIDS activist groups, the Gay Men's Health Crisis and ACT UP. And he wrote the autobiographical play, The Normal Heart. As our country has reached the grim milestone of over 100,000 deaths from COVID-19, we thought about a program in our archives, featuring songs about hard times and the ability to survive them. Margot Price is a country singer and songwriter based in Nashville who describes herself as a songbird, thunderbird, and jailbird. The jailbird part? That's literal. Price once spent a weekend behind bars after she was arrested for driving under the influence. That was the subject of her song Weekender, which we'll hear later in the show. Like most of us, Margot Price has been sheltering at home. In her case, in Nashville. She's there with her son, a newborn baby daughter, and her husband and songwriting partner Jeremy Ivy, who has been recovering from what is suspected to be COVID-19. She's been working on a new album called That's How Rumors Get Started, which is expected later this summer. In the meantime, she's just released an online album through the website Bandcamp, featuring her live 2018 performances with guest artists at the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville. It's titled Perfectly Imperfect at the Ryman, and its proceeds go to the Music Cares COVID Relief Fund. Terry spoke with Margot Price in 2017 after the release of her album All American Made. Many of her songs are autobiographical, about family and growing up in a small town in the Midwest. This song, Heart of America, is about growing up on her family's farm, which was eventually bought out by a large corporation.
Big banks took the throne. They asked that every local farmer try to dry his own corn. But the men in suits had a bigger plan than to let it be our own. When the crops came in that spring, they were blown. And Neil and Willie tried so hard in battles they have gone. But that was still long after the much bigger war had been won. And be a hard-working man. At the end of the day, if the rain it don't rain, if the bank it don't break, we just do what we can.
That's Heart of America from Margot Price's new album All American Made. Margot Price, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for coming to our show and for bringing your guitar with you. I really appreciate that.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. When you started writing songs, did you think you'd be writing about anything as personal, as autobiographical, as losing the family farm?
I think from the time that I was really young, I was always trying to, you know, express what was going on in my life and inside me, and a lot of times that came out through song. I feel like I've been trying to write Heart of America and Hands of Time. I feel like I've been trying to write those songs my whole life.
You were, according to your songs, you were two when your family lost the farm, so you probably have like no memory of actually living on the farm. Can I ask what the circumstances were that led to your family losing the farm?
Yeah, I was about two or three, and I do have a couple kind of vague memories of my grandparents packing up all their things in their home and getting rid of their dogs that they love so much and all their animals. So there is a little bit of a memory there, just knowing the gravity of it all, just how much it affected everybody. Big farming was coming in, and the banks weren't very generous in helping out the family after a hard year. So they had been told to install these grain bins that dried their corn, which typically, I guess, they would ship off and have that done. So they had invested in a lot of farming equipment that was very expensive. And then a drought came, and the combination of those two things, then the bank just kind of swept it out from under them and sold it to a large corporation.
So on your first album, there's a song called Hands of Time, which is about, you know, leaving your home, hitting the road, and, you know, launching a music career. And it seems very connected to the first song that we heard. Can you play? Can you perform some of that for us?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wrote this song actually sitting down at the piano, and I'd had the words for a really long time and could not find the right chords or the right tempo or melody. And I just kept working on it and working on it, and one day I went down and used the piano to figure out what was going on. So yeah, here's a little piece of it.
I roll out of town on the unpaved road. I was $57 from being broke. Kissed my mama and my sisters, and I said goodbye. And with my suitcase packed, I wiped the tears from my eyes. Times they were tough. Growing up at home, my daddy lost the farm when I was 2 years old. Took a job at the prison, working second shift. And that's the last time I'll let them take what should be his. So all I wanna do is make a little cash, 'cause I've worked all the bad jobs and busting my ass. I wanna buy back the farm, bring my mama home some wine, and turn back the clock on the crew. Hands of Time.
And it was kind of strange, because when I wrote that and I showed my husband, he said, I don't know if that key change works or whatever kind of modulation you're doing there. Just, I don't know. And I just kept playing it over and over. I said, yeah, it does. and then later everyone said it was genius, but right off the bat, I think it felt a little strange.
So the song that you just did, Hands of Time, refers to your father after the farm was taken away, working a job at the prison. And so is that the job that he took?
Yeah, it was. I think it's a hard job for anyone who has it. You know, nobody wants to be in a working in a prison, but he did what he had to do to put food on the table, and him and my mom worked very hard, very modest jobs to make sure that we were never without.
You know, I'm wondering, there's so much, like, in America, there's so much emphasis on, like, the heartland and the family farmer. And there's a whole set of kind of like stereotypes that go with that of what we're talking about when we talk about the heartland and the family farm. Do you feel like you fit into any of those stereotypes? Do you know what I'm saying? Because you actually lived that experience.
Yeah. Growing up in middle America, I always kind of wished that I was from somewhere else that was more romantic. It just kind of felt like there just wasn't much going on. It was so flat, the landscape, and just the winters were very cold. The work was hard. And I always, you know, dreamed of a more romantic backdrop. But you know, now when I go back, I see the beauty in it. And, you know, the more I'm away, I think the more I appreciate where I came from.
When you started singing and writing songs, why was it country music?
I always loved the stories and, you know, being able to get out an entire plot in just 3 minutes. And I think it's just the way that I sang also, because I was drawn to so many different types of music. And of course, there was a lot of country music being played in my town. But there was something about my voice that just always, I don't know if it was nasally or that I was scooping the notes, but kind of no matter what I did, I felt like I couldn't get away from singing country music.
And you went to Nashville, where you still live.
Yes.
And your great uncle is a songwriter, and I don't know that I know any of his songs, but he's a songwriter who went to Nashville and kind of made his way there. Did that open up any doors for you, at least a door in your mind, thinking someone from my family did this, so maybe I can do it too?
Well, for sure. We would come down family vacation and stay with my Uncle Bob and my Aunt Helen for a couple days. And, you know, he had gold records hanging on his wall. He's written hundreds and hundreds of songs. He wrote for George Jones, a song called Writing on the Wall. You know, he wrote for Reba. He wrote for Charlie Pride and Tanya Tucker. And there's so many people. And he had a, you know, just a regular job. And he was living in Iowa. And his wife was supportive enough when he said, I want to go to Nashville. I want to be a songwriter, that they picked up everything and moved down here. And it did seem to be this impossible dream that he had conquered. And but, you know, I do think that probably my mother thought that he could open all the right doors for me and there would be a nice, smooth transition. And I came to his house. He lives in Green Hills. And I played him some songs, like, the first week I was here. And he sat there real quiet and didn't say anything. And I said, well, what do you think? And he gave me the best advice that he could. He said, you know, go home, throw away your TV, throw away your computer, just sit there and just keep writing. And it hurt my feelings, but I needed that tough love, you know, to tell myself I did need to keep working at playing and hearing other people's songs and seeing what made a good song. So I started going out to lots of open mics and listening to everybody and cutting my teeth.
I'm going to ask you to play a song from your new album. And this is called All American Made. It's the title song. Would you introduce it for us and play a little bit of it?
Yeah. So, yeah, this song my husband and I co-wrote, and it's been around for a minute. You know, it's funny how songs kind of change their meaning as the world seems to change them for you.
How has the meaning of the song changed?
I think there's just more weight in it than at the time that I wrote it. And, you know, we wrote it during the Obama years. And I feel like I've always been one to question the people in charge. I enjoy playing the devil's advocate and being the protagonist. And so, you know, when I wrote the song, you know, I was still upset with things that were going on. But I think, you know, America's just in such a divided, heavy place right now. And I love my country so much. I don't want to leave. I just day to day wake up and read the news and feel confused. And so this song has helped on some gray mornings.
The song has a lot of verses. Do you want to choose a couple of your favorite and play them?
Yeah, starting after the lead, about halfway through the song, is where my favorite ones start. 1987, and I didn't know it then. Reagan was selling weapons to the leaders of Iran. But it won't be the first time, baby, and it won't be the end. They were all American. But I was just a child, unaware of the effects. Raised on sports and Jesus and all the usual suspects. So tell me, Mr. Petty, what do you think will happen next? It's all American made.
That is Margot Price performing for us the title track of her new album, All American Made. Tom Petty slips in there. This was when he was still alive that you wrote the song. Why are you asking him a question?
Well, I think there's nothing more American than Tom Petty, and so when I started writing those later verses there, I thought he'd be the person who'd know what actually is All American Made. I'll just ask him. And then, of course, I thought maybe if I asked him a question, he would answer me, and then I would get to meet him. So because the album came out on his birthday, what would have been his birthday. That was just really a hard time, I think, for people on both sides of the battle right now. Everybody loves Tom Petty.
yeah. What was the first music you sang? Was it country music? Did you sing in church, in school musicals?
I did a little bit of all of that. I grew up singing in church for sure, and I was in choir, so I did jazz choir and show choir and all those things. And my mom heard me singing one day. I was auditioning for like a variety type show that they put on in my school. She was washing dishes and heard my grandmother walked in, and they were shocked that I could sing the way that I could. And after that, my mom really nourished my love of singing, and she would drive me an hour away to get voice lessons from the best voice teacher that was around. Her name was Sue Clark, and so I was singing mezzo-soprano Italian songs when I was even 11 or 12, and I still find myself, trying to utilize that technique of breathing and phrasing and but it's a little early for me to be singing right now. I think my voice always warms up after 8 p.m.
We're recording this in the afternoon, but I think you sound great. Share with us something that you learned from your voice teacher that you otherwise might never have known.
Sue Clark, she's, I found out she's not around now. I tried to look her up so I could get back in touch with her and thank her. She taught me to try not to clear my throat and not to cough because it can damage your vocal cords. You know, one thing she always told me not to do was belt and switch over into my head voice. But after I started getting into like Led Zeppelin and Janis Joplin, I wanted to, blow my voice out. So it's been a learning experience to, use that classical training, but then also try to figure out ways to make my voice sound edgier or louder, or just more rock and roll at times.
That's country singer and songwriter Margot Price speaking with Terry Gross in 2017. We'll hear more after a break. And we'll remember Larry Kramer, the writer and AIDS activist who died of pneumonia on Wednesday. He was 84 years old. Here's more of Margot Price's song All American Made, which is included in her album of live performances recorded at the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville. The album is called Perfectly Imperfect at the Ryman, and it's now available online with proceeds to benefit the Music Cares COVID Relief Fund. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Woke up from a movie I immediately forgot. Got a heartache on the bottom and a headache on the top. Part of me that hurts the worst is the one I just can't spot, and it's all American made. Well, everywhere I go, somebody puts me in the dirt. Everything I say Somebody says they said it first, but I don't need 10 million, baby, just give me one that works. It's all American made. Well, all the Midwest farms are turning into plastic homes, and my uncle started drinking when the bank denied the loan. But now it's liver failure and his mad cow being cloned, and it's all American made. Well, I have been all over, but I can't help feeling stuck. Something in my bloodline, or something in my gut, says drive on out to Nashville in a rusted pickup truck.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from LA Times Studios, funded by Amazon Studios for the podcast Paperclip, inspired by its Emmy-eligible drama series Hunters, starring Al Pacino and Logan Lerman. Join host Michael Ian Black as he teams up with a Cold War historian to explore Operation Paperclip, a top-secret program that brought Nazi scientists to America. It's a story of principles compromised and war crimes overlooked. Available now on Apple Podcasts and all other platforms.
We're listening back to an interview Terry recorded in 2017 with country singer and songwriter Margot Price. At the moment, she's sheltering at home with her husband and two children in Nashville.
So you write a lot of songs with your husband, Jeremy Ivey, who's also a musician, who's featured on your album playing bass, guitar, harmonica. How did you start writing songs together? Like, which came first, having a relationship or writing songs?
Well, we met through music. We met at a Belmont college party where neither of us were going to school. We were just hanging out with all these hip musicians, and I had wanted to go there, but couldn't really afford the tuition. And so we were hanging out, and we met, and he was coming out of a divorce and really didn't want a relationship. But yeah, the first night we hung out, we both played a song for each other, and then the relationship kind of grew out of our love for music. And he sold me this 8-track digital recorder, and so I would call him all the time to figure. I didn't really know how to work all the buttons on it, and I'd call him and be like, oh, I got the reverb stuck on this. I can't get it off. And then we started playing together. I actually started backing him up first, and I was playing drums in a band of his. It was called River Bottom, and then I broke up that band. There were problems going on in there, and I called it out. And so then the two of us just kind of started writing together and singing together and playing together, and haven't stopped yet.
So when you're writing songs with your husband, how is the process different from when you're writing a song by yourself?
Well, you know, a lot of times we'll bring ideas to each other that we can't finish, or other times we will just sit down and start writing a song together from the get-go. It's always different, but it's really nice to be able to write with someone where you just talk things out in the room, and you know, we just have this kind of communication where I feel like sometimes when I'm talking out loud, I don't know if I'm saying it to him. We share a brain at this point. We've been together for about 14 years. And so it just feels kind of like we're talking through things, talking the song out. And if an idea is dumb, then we are very quick to tell the other person. And if it's great, then, you know, we nourish it and encourage it. So, yeah, it's always different.
One of the songs that you co-wrote with your husband that's on the new album All American Made is called Learning to Lose. And that's a duet with you and Willie Nelson. So you were lucky enough to have him sing with you on the album. So of all the songs you could have chosen to say, sing this one with me, why was it that song?
Well, when we were writing that song, we were listening to a lot of Willie Nelson records. And you know how it is when you get inspired by an artist and you kind of go through long phases of listening to them and really digging in deep. And so, yeah, that song we wrote in our bedroom. I had a cup of coffee. I was wearing my robe. We just barely woke up. And Jeremy grabbed the guitar, and we just sat there, and it came out so quickly. And right when we finished it, we started thinking and saying to each other, wouldn't it be amazing if we could get Willie Nelson to sing on this song?
Why don't we hear that song with you and Willie Nelson? This is Learning to Lose, and it's from my guest Margo Price's new album, All American Made.
And the only devil I've ever seen was in the mirror. The only enemy I know is in my mind. Won't you tell me
how long must I pay all these dues?
Won't you tell me when learning to lose. And you
said it, oh, but say
that it's not true. Is winning really
That's Margo Price and Willie Nelson duetting on a song she co-wrote with her husband, Jeremy Ivey. The song is called Learning to Lose, and it's from her new album, All American Made. So, you know, in terms of, like, moving to Nashville to, like, launch your performing career there, one of the kind of central stories about your early career was how you and your husband sold the car and pawned your wedding ring so that you'd have enough money to pay for the studio time to make your first album?
Yeah, we kind of put all our eggs in one basket, and it was really scary. He just came into the kitchen one morning, and he's like, that's it. We're never going to be able to save up enough money to make the record that you need, and so I'm just going to sell the car. And I tried to talk him out of it, but he went down to Gallatin Road and sold it to CarMax. And he came home, and then we booked the studio time the very next day.
And your ring, too? You pawned that?
Yeah, we went down. I went to about three different pawn shops, and none of them wanted to give me very much because there was a crack in it, and it's missing one of the little diamonds on the side. But they were going to give me $300, and we just agreed to get rid of anything that didn't suit us, and we did sell some music equipment too, but I, you know, the ring, it did kind of hit home, and my husband said, it's just material possession, it doesn't matter. And while I agreed with him, I still liked my wedding ring with the chip in it, and so he eventually went back and got it out of the hawk for me.
And you have it now?
I do. I'm actually looking at it. It's still got a crack, and it's still missing one of the diamonds. I haven't even went to go get it fixed.
We're listening to an interview from our archives with Margo Price. We'll continue her conversation with Terry Gross after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR and the following message come from DuckDuckGo. Do you want the same internet but more privacy? DuckDuckGo can help. They help millions of people like you get privacy online without any trade-offs. With one download, you can search and browse privately, avoiding trackers. DuckDuckGo. Privacy simplified.
Let's return to Terry's 2017 interview with Margo Price, the country singer and songwriter.
So you've said that your parents were afraid that you'd, they weren't sure how it would finally work out. So it's working out really good, but they didn't know that at the time. You have a song called Weekender, which is about spending the weekend in the county jail. Did that happen to you?
It did. Yeah, that was one of the lowest points. I feel like I'd been running wild for quite some time, and it was really only a matter of time before it was all going to catch up with me. And came home one night after staying at a friend's, and I tried to call a cab, and the cab didn't come. It was kind of before Uber and Lyft were really in cities, and I just made some bad. I shouldn't have driven. I thought I was fine. I gave it time. I ate some food. I waited a long time, but I ended up hitting a telephone pole in front of a couple police officers, and then thought about outrunning them for a little bit, and then I realized that wasn't possible, so I finally pulled over and walked the line, and yeah, I got a good lawyer, but I still had to go do this weekend in jail. And he had told me, he's like, oh, it's a white collar thing, it's not going to be a big deal, it's really not going to be scary. And when I showed up at the Davidson County Jail, I realized that I was in there with, you know, people who had murdered people and done some really bad things. And just being in there was an eye-opening experience in more than one ways, more than just, you know, for self-motivation to get better and never end up back there again. But it was also, it was just sad to see women who were in that situation and whose lives had taken them there.
Were you injured in the accident?
No, I wasn't. Yeah, I was wearing my seatbelt, and, you know, it was late at night. Nobody else was around. But it was really scary for my husband, because they called him, and he thought that I had died the way that they, kind of explained it at first. Mm-hmm. Yeah, after that happened, I really realized that I was not taking care of myself, and I quit drinking for a good long time mm-hmm. at that point.
Can you do, like, a verse of Weekender?
Yeah. Let's see. I went down to the county jail and turned myself in, spending all my weekends here, far from my good time and friends. Things went bad, things went worse, guess you know the end. The only thing I know for sure is I ain't going back again. They took me down to cell block B after stripping off my clothes, put me in a monkey suit and threw me in the throes. Like a rat in a maze, a cow in a herd, or a sparrow with a broken wing. Now I know the reason why a caged bird has to sing. 'Cause I'm just a weekender in the Davidson County Jail. My old man ain't got the cash to even go my bail. Should've listened to my mama, maybe quit my life of sin before I went back sliding again. This one might be my favorite. Bed is hard and the room is cold. My cellmate's got a cough. She takes her meds and sleeps all day. Got 6 more weeks till she's off. She said she beat her boyfriend up while high on crack cocaine. Now she sits and watches her young life go down the drain. 'Cause she's just a weekender in the Davidson County Jail, and her old man ain't got the cash to even go her bail. She should listen to her mama, maybe quit her life of sin before she went back sliding again.
Oh, thanks for singing that. That song, yeah. Weekender, is on Margo Price's first album, which is called Midwest Farmer's Daughter. Margo Price, thank you so much, and thank you for being so generous and singing and playing for us. It was really just wonderful. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
Margo Price visited Fresh Air in 2017. Her online charity album, collecting some of her live performances with special guests at Nashville's Ryman Auditorium, is called Perfectly Imperfect at the Ryman. It's available now at the website Bandcamp. She's also working on a new album, due this summer. After a break, we remember Larry Kramer, the writer and AIDS activist who died Wednesday at age 84. This is Fresh Air.
The news has been hard to escape. So take a deep breath and join us for NPR's All Songs Considered. It's more than a music discovery podcast, it's relief, with new episodes every Tuesday and Friday as we share the week's best new albums and lots of music to calm the nerves. Hear All Songs Considered wherever you get podcasts.
There's no getting around it. The coronavirus pandemic has upended everything. And daily decisions made by the White House and Congress will radically impact the human and economic toll. To keep up with the latest, join us on the NPR Politics Podcast. We'll cut through the noise and let you know what decisions are being made and how they affect you.
Larry Kramer, the influential writer and AIDS activist who co-founded both the Gay Men's Health Crisis and the protest group ACT UP, died of pneumonia Wednesday. He was 84 years old. As an activist, Kramer was on the front lines early, fighting for the government to more aggressively research and combat the HIV virus. He wrote passionate articles about the rising death tolls, as well as stage dramas about the AIDS epidemic. One of those was the autobiographical play The Normal Heart, which was filmed as an HBO movie in 2014. Another was The Destiny of Me, which was running off-Broadway when Terry Gross interviewed Larry Kramer in 1992. One of the characters in that play was based on Dr. Anthony Fauci, who was the government's head researcher when AIDS first surfaced. He and Kramer clashed often at first, but eventually came to respect each other. In Kramer's New York Times obituary yesterday, Dr. Fauci said, quote, "Once you got past the rhetoric, you found that Larry Kramer made a lot of sense and that he had a heart of gold," unquote. During their 1992 interview, Larry Kramer told Terry that he began to empathize with Fauci after the doctor invited him and other activists to participate in the process of developing medications and policies to fight AIDS.
He invited us inside, and when you get to know a person, that makes hate harder. He's a genuinely likable person, and I think we grew genuinely fond of each other, so it's kind of hard to call a man that you feel that way about a murderer. I will say I've learned a lesson, and I don't know that I ever want to go inside again, that I feel I'm much more useful as a gadfly, as someone from yelling from the outside. I wish I did not know Tony so well. I wish I did not know Dr. Gallo so well, or the cast of characters that I've come to know and respect.
Well, I wonder if knowing some of the doctors and researchers better than you used to, and having them become more human, more likable to you, if that's given you any second thoughts about some of the tactics of ACT UP, the group that you co-founded.
I have to say no. I don't think that I... I will defend the tactics of ACT UP very strenuously. I think that without those tactics, we wouldn't have been invited inside in the first place. We would never have had the opportunity to be listened to. or to be taken seriously. We would not have been able to, the best instance is that there's a drug out now called, from Bristol-Myers, called DDI, and they're about to release another one called D4T, and these are both valuable alternatives to AZT from Burroughs Wellcome, and those two good drugs from Bristol-Myers are out there because of us, literally. We asked to meet with Bristol-Myers. I wrote a letter to the president, Richard Gelb, the CEO, and I sent him our usual packet saying all our good things and also about our protests. And he was nervous, but he opened the door, and we sat down with the scientists. And but again, we couldn't have gotten in the door if Gelb hadn't been frightened of us.
You've been diagnosed with HIV. Well, you were first diagnosed with that in 1988. Have you had any symptoms, or is it just testing positive?
Well, I've not had any opportunistic infections. There have been, you know, certain things that have that people with this condition habitually experienced, but nothing of any earth-shattering import. I've been very lucky thus far, and I believe I have been infected since easily the late 70s, so I'm what's called a long-term survivor of one sort or another, and I don't know why I'm not dead. And, of course, this is one of the things we've been most anxious to ask the government to study.
How has having HIV affected your sense of priorities as an activist and your sense of what you as an individual should be devoting your time to?
Well, I would rather answer that by saying it's made me very life very precious, et cetera, and I want to finish my life's work, and which is to write certain things about it. But it has taught me an enormous amount about life and humanity and human beings, and most of what I've learned has not been terribly pleasant. I just have seen humanity at its worst. I have seen bureaucracy at its worst. And I've seen bigotry at its worst. And I've seen precious little countervailing charitable acts of love to balance any of that to the extent the awfulness has been allowed. Yes, of course, there are wonderful people who have been working on the front lines. But for 12 years, two wretched presidents refused in any way to help save lives and allowed other people to intentionally become sick so that they too might die. And that's a very strong indictment. And it's just, I did not start out to be an activist. I did not start out to be indeed political. I was a businessman. I was in the film industry. I was assistant to the presidents of both Columbia and United Artists. I went to Yale. I was on my way to making a great deal of money. I was not a gay man first by any manner of means until I became involved in fighting AIDS, and because someone close to me died. And suddenly, I was none of these things. I was no longer the white man from Yale. I was a faggot without a name.
Larry, do you remember how you first heard about AIDS, the first signs of it that you saw or read about?
Oh, yes. There were, I guess, several incidents. The first official real quaking in my stomach was in July of 1981 when the first article appeared in the back pages of the New York Times announcing the discovery in gay men of a rare cancer, and it was announced by a doctor whom I knew at NYU. And I rushed up to see him, and he told me what was going on, and I just knew then that, boy, this was just going to be awful. And then as he told me about it and what was happening, my mind went back to incidences over the preceding couple of years where I had friends who were mysteriously ill, lovers carrying their lovers around literally in their arms from doctor to doctor, from hospital to hospital, begging for, have you heard of anything that this could remotely resemble? And it has been 12 years of horror, death after death after death. One does become inured to it in a strange sort of way. I don't feel near the appalling horrors on a basis as I did in those early days.
You feel like you've adjusted to death, and that's probably not a good thing to adjust to.
It certainly isn't. It certainly isn't.
Have you counted the number of friends that you've lost, or did you just stop counting?
I stopped counting. I used to keep a little book, and I forgot even what year it was when it reached 500, and I just stopped at 500. But you have to remember that having co-founded GMHC and having founded ACT UP and just being so well-known in the community, I probably, you know, I knew more people than your average gay person. But I think by now there isn't anyone in New York who has not certainly had many dozens of people lost.
Do you know what you'll be writing next? Is there a project you're working on now?
I have so many projects that I don't know that I have time for them all. But I've been working for about 10 years on a very, very, very long novel called The American People, which I will write till the day I die. It's like I sort of Proustian, you know, when he finished it, he died. That's, I think, what's going to happen with this book. I feel it's almost my responsibility to write about AIDS stuff and about what it's been like to be gay in this time in history. And fortunately, I'm still healthy, and I feel like I've been given this opportunity to write this story because I was, for whatever reason, put on the front lines of the battlefield when the war started in 1981, and there are not many writers of us who are still alive, and I know where all the bodies are buried, both symbolically and literally, and that I have to somehow, and it's an enormous challenge and an enormous task, I must somehow find a way to make art out of all of this into the best, damn, biggest, greatest novel I have it in me to write, and I'm enjoying that challenge.
Well, Larry, I wish you good luck with your writing,
Thank
and
you.
I wish you good health, and good luck with your new play.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Larry Kramer speaking to Terry Gross in 1992. The writer and longtime activist died Wednesday at age 84. And he ended up finishing that novel. The second volume of The American People came out earlier this year. On Monday's show, Terry speaks with actress Christine Baranski, who stars in The Good Fight, playing a brilliant commanding partner in a progressive law firm. It's a spin-off of The Good Wife. Baranski also is known for her comedic roles and for work in stage and screen musicals, including Into the Woods, Chicago, and Mame. I hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Charlie Kyer. Our technical director is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support by Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Thea Challoner, and Seth Kelly. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.